What an irony the Bible teaches. It says that those of us who recognize that we're entitled to nothing are the same ones who will inherit everything.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
Jack, wouldn't it be so great if we knew that Jesus was in town and he was going to be teaching about something? It would just be an incredible thing to go sit at his feet and listen to him, listen to his voice, look in his eyes, see the man. It would just be, what an incredible experience.
Yeah, it would. I'd settle for the Apostle Paul, but...
Why not go all the way? We
sure,
can't have
right.
either.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I was reading... I was reading the Sermon on the Mount, and of course those are words right from Jesus' mouth, and they are incredibly touching. It says in Matthew 5:1, "And when he saw the multitudes, he went up on the mountain, and after he sat down, his disciples came to him, and opening his mouth, he began to teach them." That's what I would like to hear. That's what I would like to be able to be in on firsthand. We've been talking about what is biblical spirituality. What does it really look like? There's a lot of answers out there. I think we've come up with one that probably, again, isn't very typical. But I think it's very rich and probably, I think, very helpful and maybe freeing, again, to people. So we just got in two broadcasts, we just got through two verses of the Sermon on the Mount. So how about if I read them?
Sure. Yeah.
And will you review?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
"And opening his mouth, he began to teach them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted."
The poor in spirit, I think, is talking about their self-concept. So he's ironically saying those people who have a concept of themselves as not being rich and wealthy, but a self-concept of themselves as being without, as being deprived somehow, those are the people who are the lucky ones, the fortunate ones, who are going to receive a blessing from God. And that blessing will come in the form of the kingdom of heaven. The poverty or the lack that the child of God experiences comes down to two things, I think. One, recognizing that all the stuff that this world has to offer is not really valuable. It doesn't constitute riches because it really doesn't satisfy and fulfill and give us what we need and what our existence craves. If we don't see that, then we're inclined to think of ourselves as rich. If we have the stuff from this world that we want, then we're inclined to think that we're really wealthy. So only those who see clearly that this world is passing away, is futile, and is not fulfilling are people who are even in a position to see themselves as poor. And the other aspect of it is to recognize that the thing that really does make us rich is integrity, wisdom, character, ultimately righteousness itself, godliness itself. That's the only thing that can really satisfy us. So the other perception that the poor in spirit have is that the very thing that could make them rich, they are highly deficient in that. They don't have any of that. They are not godly people.
They're humble people.
And therefore they're humble, exactly.
So it's saying fortunate are those who have such an accurate concept of themselves that they have come to be humbled.
Yeah, and particularly humbled with respect to their human and moral condition. Their human condition in that they recognize the futility of their existence without godliness, and moral in the sense that it's their moral worthiness that's being measured, and they recognize that they are woefully short of being morally worthy. Yeah, those are the poor in spirit. Then he says, goes on to say, blessed are those who mourn.
You didn't go to the second part, and I think that's really important. Fortunate are those who have been humbled. That sounds so, that doesn't sound like something we want to go after. But then it says, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Yeah, and what he's talking about, we mentioned this last week, all of these little short things are called the Beatitudes. All of these Beatitudes are ultimately suggesting that the reward of these people that are going to be described here is citizenship in the kingdom of God one day in the age to come. And that's really the existence that we were created for. It's the only thing that can satisfy us ultimately. So to be rewarded with that is to be rewarded with everything that reality has to offer. You can't do any better than that.
It's the best of the best.
Yeah. The next one is, blessed are those who mourn, or we could translate it, weep. Blessed are those who weep, for they shall be comforted. What are we weeping or mourning over? I think it's linked to the first one, being poor in spirit. We are weeping and mourning over the condition of our lives right now. We're not satisfied with them. We're not. We don't find ultimate joy in my life right now, and in fact, we find it a real tragedy that I am not godly, that I am not a person of integrity and wisdom. We find it so tragic that we weep. And I think we talked last week about, he doesn't mean that literally, in the sense that if I don't find myself constantly shedding tears, there's something spiritually wrong with me. I think he's talking about that deep down inner person and my real bottom line evaluation of my life. What is my bottom line evaluation of my life? That this is fine, or that there's something really desperately wrong with this existence I have right now. The child of God, the truly spiritual person, is the person whose bottom line is, there's something really drastically, desperately wrong with my existence right now. And therefore, he captures that by saying, we weep.
It's such a paradox. It says, we weep, and in weeping, we're comforted.
Mm-hmm.
I really see that a lot in my work with people who aren't pushing against not knowing reality, but in seeing the reality of their own sin, of perhaps what's happened to them that's very painful, of an experience that they're going through, instead of tightening up and hardening up and saying, I won't look at that, instead they turn and they look at it directly. And out of that, there's a lot of mourning, there's a lot of sadness, there's a lot of grief. And paradoxically, that's when we're most comforted, because we're standing on the truth. We're standing on reality.
Right. And then, of course, the ultimate comfort is the very thing that we are weeping about. The brokenness of my existence, the futility of my existence, is actually going to be fixed in the eternal kingdom, in the kingdom of heaven that is to come. And there's our ultimate comfort that he's talking about.
Even bigger.
Yeah.
Okay, so should we go on?
Sure.
We're moving right along here, our third week, third verse. So blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth.
Okay. Here I have a quibble with the translation. The translation you read and my translation has gentle. The idea of that word seems to be the not presumptuous, basically. Some translations have meek, which I like, except that meek is not a word we use in our street idiom very much anymore, so it doesn't really mean much to us. The opposite of the person that he's talking about is the person who has a real sense of entitlement, who presumes upon God's blessing, presumes upon God's mercy, has a perspective that God owes me something. What he's describing here is the opposite of that, the person who recognizes, who acknowledges, who sees clearly that God owes me nothing. I am entitled to nothing. I am I am first of all a creature, a mere creature, and secondly, I'm a broken creature, a creature who really has not done anything to prove my worthiness of God. I have, every time I've opened my mouth, proved my unworthiness of God. And if I see that about, so it's very, it's again tied into the Beatitudes ahead here.
Very much.
I'm weeping and I'm poor in spirit because I have this realistic, humble appraisal of who I am. If we put this in its historical context, Jesus has in mind the Pharisees, who were very much people with attitudes of entitlement. I mean, they were quite willing to trot out their credentials to people because they thought that they were really pretty impressive to God, that God had to be pretty awed by them. And the irony of what he's saying here is that you people who think that you have reached the pinnacle of spirituality, who think that you are the most righteous and godly people in our society, you are in fact even out of the game. You're not even in the game. The people who are in the game are the people who have come to realize that they fall way short and have nothing to offer, have no credentials. Those are the meek.
Well, that's really important piece here, to understand what true biblical spirituality is. Because we think of people who look like the Pharisees as spiritual.
Right.
So let's look a little bit closer at what characterized a Pharisee's life. Can you describe one for us?
Well, a lot of it was that their lives were full of their own version of religious piety. They tithed meticulously. They were notorious for, they prided themselves in the fact that if they went to the marketplace and they bought some spices, since the law required them to tithe everything, they would tithe their spices too. So if they had a little handful of spices that they bought, they would carefully brush off a tenth of the spices and give that to the temple and tithe that to the temple. The average person thought that that was a little bit silly, and so they didn't do that, but not the Pharisees. They were meticulous. They prayed to a regimen. I think three times a day they prayed as a regular discipline, as a routine. They fasted twice a week. They gave alms routinely and dramatically and spectacularly. Jesus describes them as having somebody go before them and blow a trumpet whenever they were going to give alms. So that
they really showed off
that
they were giving to the poor.
Yeah. What Jesus' description of them that I think fits the most is he says of the Pharisees, you tithe mint and dill and cumin, but you neglect the weightier matters of the law. And I don't remember what he lists there, justice, something and something else. That, as is always the tendency in religion, the things that are accessible to us, are doable, are the things that we focus on. The things that are impossible for us as sinful human beings, we just tend to kind of ignore. So if you look at Phariseeism in our modern culture today, we look at lifestyle issues. Do I or do I not go to movies? Do I or do I not own a television? Do I or do I not play cards? Do I or do I not drink alcohol? We look at lifestyle issues and we decide, my piety is demonstrated in this lifestyle that I have chosen for myself. And we get real proud about all of my lifestyle choices. But the nitty-gritty of life, am I patient? Am I kind? Am I compassionate? Am I merciful? Those we just kind of go, oh well, I mean, I'm only human after all. And we don't allow my failure with respect to what Jesus would call the weightier matters of the law. We don't allow any self-evaluation, my failure in those regard, to wake me up to the fact that I'm a broken human being. And so we create this illusion for ourselves that we are godly because of really relatively easy lifestyle choices and the impossible moral decisions to be a godly person. We don't even look at those. We don't focus on those.
We major on the superficial.
Exactly.
And even though the superficial sometimes are important things, it isn't unimportant that I pay attention to how I spend my money, for example. But it's more important to what is the intent behind that, what is going on in my heart. Right. And that is much more weighty. I look at just the money spent as opposed to maybe I gave, like the Pharisees, alms to the poor. Maybe I didn't blow a trumpet to tell everybody, but perhaps inside I have a sense of, okay, now I'm a spiritual person. Now I'm someone that God would really think was great. Or I am kind of better than my neighbor because he doesn't give to the poor. Or I give more. All of those things that kind of make me entitled to be a person that God is pleased with, those things really show that I'm not a spiritual person because I am, my moral character is so hurting, and I'm not seeing that.
And you don't see it, exactly, yeah. That's crucial. The critique of the Pharisees as blowing the trumpet, for example, before they give alms, you know, we tend to think, oh, I see, okay, so true spirituality is not blowing a trumpet before I give alms. Well, that's not right either.
Right.
Because even if I'm only an audience of one, I'm still playing to the audience. And true spirituality does not play to the audience acting out the part of a godly and righteous person and then feeling good about my performance. True spirituality is true appraisal of myself. And a true appraisal of myself is that I'm broken. That I'm desperately wicked, really, at the core of my being. God save me, God have mercy upon me. That's the insight of the truly spiritual person. So even if I tend to avoid grandstanding, spiritual and religious grandstanding, that doesn't make things okay. That doesn't make me spiritual. The key is the point that you made about the superficiality of this thing. Real, deep down, authentic spirituality is an inward thing at the core of my being. It's not something that I'm tacking on the outside of my life. Oftentimes, what people want from Bible teachers, for example, is what they call practical teaching. But what they mean by that, what they mean by practical is, what you're saying that the Bible requires of me is so deep, so inward, so profound, so inaccessible to me that I can't get there. So give me something that's accessible to me. Give me something that I can do. Give me 3 steps to follow. Give me 4 techniques to employ. Give me a pattern to follow in my life, and I'll do that. Well, the temptation, of course, is for a Bible teacher to offer that. Okay, let me give you the pattern. Let me give you the template. Let me give you the techniques. But the problem is, what have I accomplished as a Bible teacher when they have conformed to the pattern, when they've done the techniques? I've given them something to tack on the outside of their lives, but it hasn't made any transformation of their inward being at all. It hasn't changed anything. I have not advanced their spirituality at all. And that's what characterized the Pharisees, is this kind of what Jesus called hypocrisy. That was the term he used for it. This play acting, this acting out a role, this acting out a part that was very accessible to them. I mean, who can't give alms if they have enough motivation to do it? But who can change their own heart? Who can make that almsgiving be authentic and genuine from the inside out and not just a kind of playing to some audience or another that leads to their own pride and patting themselves on the back and taking stock of the fact that they're such good people? That's at the essence of legalism, Phariseeism, false piety, and therefore false spirituality. That's what it's all about.
So, for example, the Pharisees would have been very practical in their perspective of their spirituality. They were tithing everything, down to even the little spices, and that was kind of their formula. That was their rules to be a spiritual person, and that's what they tacked on the outside. They would say by doing those things that they were spiritual people. And you're saying, no, that's just very superficial. That's just the outside. What is the intent of your heart? What is the motivation of your heart? What's going on inside? Because a person could give a 10% of everything and they could have a heart that really is wanting good. I can give 10% and just be showing off. It really isn't what's going on in the outside as much as what is coming out of my heart. But if I give a person a rule from the outside, what it does is it helps me shift my attention from inside to outside of myself.
Mm-hmm.
It puts it away from me as opposed to inside of me. And that's the crucial difference. But we can be practical, Jack, and you and I have had this discussion recently, and I think it's an important one in our Bible teaching, by helping people recognize what's going on inside of their hearts. So helping people look at, okay, what is the intent of your heart? Are you doing this out of a desire to worship God, to care about people, to express a gratefulness to God? Is that the intent of your heart? Are you doing it because you're afraid of what people will think about you if you don't give like this? Well, helping people look at the intent of their heart and help them, that helps them then recognize who they really are and have this accurate self-concept that we're talking about here, where ultimately, if we're asking those kinds of questions, we're going to be brought to a place where we're poor in spirit, where we mourn, and where we sense we don't have a sense of entitlement. Because when we look deeply at the intent of our heart, it's not a pretty picture. Does that then make us despair? No. It just helps us see who we are and recognize what a good gift God gave us, what a merciful gift He gave us, because we don't have hearts that earn Him, that are entitled to Him. He just came and He bestowed grace on us, even though He knew the stuff of our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Even those things, we have to keep in mind, though, that our hearts are so wicked and so subtly deceptive that if you were to help me see the condition of my heart with the kind of discernment and the kind of wisdom that you're talking about, where we see someone, we help someone see, but do you see what your motivations could be other than righteousness? I could borrow that insight from you, and I could mouth that insight, and I could repeat sentences that reflect the insight that you have had into the human heart without ever owning it myself, without ever seeing it, really.
But you know how I would know if you saw it or not? It's if you mourned.
Yeah, exactly.
If there was
absolutely
true repentance, not just I repent or I'm sorry, but there's this kind of welling up from inside that often brings weeping.
Right.
And that's, I guess we can pretend weep, but I think...
Yeah, we can.
We can pretend that, but mm-hmm. if there's a real agonizing of the heart, because I've seen myself accurately, I think that's a pretty good sign that I've looked.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Assuming the weeping is authentic and not grandstanding for you because you've written a different script for me. And we can do that, too, and we need to not lose sight of the fact that we can do that. We can fake every one of these Beatitudes, give our own interpretation, like an actor gives an interpretation of a script, give my interpretation of the script, and try to play out that script for people. The bottom line is, and here's what a lot of people are not going to like, but the bottom line here is that true spirituality is ultimately inaccessible to me. I cannot make myself a spiritual person. The only one who can turn me into a spiritual man or woman is the Spirit of God at work in my heart, enlightening, opening my eyes, opening my ears, making my heart a heart that wants to know God and loves God. And I can't do that about for myself. That's the other way in which I think people press for practicality in the false sense, not in the good sense, is... They say they get it finally. They come to see, oh, I see. It's not enough for me to play act. It's not enough for me to play out a role. It has to be authentic from within. Okay, Jack, how do I make it authentic from within? Give me 3 steps. You know, tell me 5 things that will somehow work to change my own heart. And at that point, And again, as a Bible teacher, it'd be very tempting to try to answer that question. Oh, yeah, that's a good question. Let me give you 5 steps. And I may come up with something. I may make something up. But the reality is, there is nothing that I can do to change my own heart. What is it? The Proverbs or Ecclesiastes? Can a leopard change his own spots? The fundamental reality of our lives is that God, the author of our being, is either going to make us children of God or he's not. And if he is, he's the one who's going to invisibly, like the wind blowing through my soul, going to have to change me and transform me into a child of God, a truly spiritual person who matches the description of Matthew 5.
Mm-hmm. I'm really with you there. I really agree with you there. It is the Spirit of God works with us like the wind. We don't see it. It just works within us. And as a person that wants to follow God, who cares about what God wants in my life, I do see myself very much working alongside him to work at seeing reality and seeing truth. How do I do that? I do that in part by trying to understand the scriptures. That helps me look at truth. It helps me see his mind. That's an important piece.
Mm-hmm.
I also work very hard at trying to look at the motivations of my own heart and being willing to go beyond the superficial, even when it's painful to me. I think of people in my life who I have wanted to change because their way of relating to me is so difficult for me, especially people who are close to me. Their way of relating to me requires that their way of relating to me is just hurtful. It's painful. They say things or do things that I'm thinking of a particular person that are really belittling to me. I don't think that this particular person knows it. I think that it's just their way of being in the world. My approach to this person has been, look, you've got to change. You've got to see the world my way. You've got to understand how belittling you are. But I was on the phone with them a couple of days ago, and they asked me to explain something to them, and I said, you know what? I don't really think I can because I speak Chinese, and you don't. And we finally come to this understanding of, oh, we speak different languages. I can't explain to him what's going on with me. He just doesn't understand it, and I think he's come to understand that he doesn't understand it. But where does that leave me? It leaves me with a person who continues to relate to me in a really hurtful way, and they have no idea that they're doing that. So what I can do is decide not to change them and to live with the loss of not having a relationship that is really important to me, and to live in the pain of being belittled pretty consistently. It's very easy to just want to continue to change that person and to be self-righteous and to think that's really a better way for them to be. It would be a better way for them not to be belittling, but that self-righteousness on my part is wrong. And I had to look at that self-righteousness and look at the rule and the push and the shove that I had toward them and say, you know, Christine, that's wrong. Regardless of what they're doing, that's wrong. And so that kind of examination of the intent of my heart and what's going on in my relationships, rather than say, just that person is wrong, I need to turn my finger around and say, what's going on with me that's contributing to this problem? Especially when I see myself pointing my finger at somebody else. Certainly in those times, I need to look at myself. It doesn't mean that I can't talk to them about it. I can't try and work with them on it. But in this particular case, it's not going to work. They don't get it. It's not going to change. Sometimes it changes in talking to people. But it's not going to change in my just getting bigger and bigger and more self-righteous. Is the worser of the two evils.
Right. I think the key is in what you just described. You're looking at that came is something you chose to do, something you wanted to do, something that emerged from inside.
Yes.
That came from inside. And
because I don't want to be a hurtful person.
Right.
I value that.
That's the thing that is so key to understand, I think, about spirituality, is that it's something that emerges from within and affects us. If I were to come to you and say, look at yourself, I could do that and I could keep one eye on you and wonder how I'm doing. You know, am I doing this right, or am I doing this well enough? But if it didn't come from within me, if it's not something that I voluntarily chose to do because I wanted to not be a hurtful person, because I wanted to be righteous, because I wanted to be godly, because I wanted to be true, I wanted to be authentic, and that was my motivation, then again, I may go through the same motions that you did, but it's not real. It's not really the real McCoy, the authentic article. True spirituality is born of God, not born of my playing to some audience among human beings. And that's what makes it so difficult for us, because what we really want and what we really crave is for someone to just tell me the steps and I will do them. And in the final analysis, it's not following the steps of a master, it's being a master dancer yourself, just kind of a spontaneously graceful dancer from inside, not following the steps that somebody else has given me.
Okay, I have this little rabbit trail for you.
Okay.
You said that you wanted to change your translation of gentle to being a person that's not presumptuous or doesn't have a sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
Jack, how is it that you come to feel comfortable being able to change the language of this translation? I think people might say that in itself is presumptuous.
Well, okay, but what they have to keep in mind is the translation in front of them, Blessed Are the Gentle, was some scholar who had studied Greek, perhaps Hebrew, and had given it their best judgment as to what they understood that Greek word to mean in this particular sentence, in this particular context. It wasn't God who chose this English word. It wasn't an apostle who chose this English word. It was a translator. And that translator, it's just like you or me. They have more experience. They have more knowledge of Greek, perhaps, than your average Christian. They have studied and engaged in more scholarship. But that doesn't make them infallible. That just makes them experienced.
So when you approach the Bible from your experience, you feel a freedom to pay attention to the words and decide if that scholar really was seeing it as close to the Greek as he possibly could have.
Right, right. Now, I read Greek, so it's not, you know, it's... I'm a fellow scholar, in a sense. I'm a fellow student of the language along with that translator, or translators, as the case may be. So I really do consider myself their peer in that regard. It's not like I'm somebody who's never seen a word of Greek in my life saying I don't like the way they translated that, so I'm going to change it.
Okay, that's what I was trying to get at.
Yeah.
And how long have you known Greek, Jack, and been studying it?
Well, let's see, close to 30 years now.
Okay, and are you pretty fluent in the biblical?
Well, I wouldn't call myself fluent. I mean, to be fluent, you know, you just pick it up and read it, but I'm constantly stumbling over vocabulary that I have to look up and stuff like that, so I wouldn't call myself fluent, but I do okay. I mean, I'm pretty comfortable with the language.
Okay.
And in this particular case, I did what you would call a word study, and that is I looked at the word where it's used everywhere in the New Testament and looked at where it gets used to translate Hebrew words in the Old Testament, and tried to specifically study what does this word mean, what is its range of meaning, what is its field of meaning. And frankly, gentle is really kind of a stretch. I'm going by memory here, but as I recall, I was a little astounded that any translator would translate it gentle, because in no context does that seem to really be the issue. And maybe it's an issue even in the English. Maybe what they mean by gentle is not what I mean by gentle in English. Maybe that's the problem. But what I typically think of as gentle is kind of a softness of character and personality, kind of a...
tender person.
Yeah, a really tender person by personality. And not that there's anything wrong with being tender by personality, but that doesn't seem to be the issue here.
Okay.
That's not what he's getting at.
Okay, I was just thinking people might say, wait a minute, can you just change those words to fit what you want them to be? And I know that not to be the case, that you are a student of the language and you take it very seriously.
Yeah, yes, I do. It's hard for people who haven't worked in translation to appreciate what the issues are and what's involved. And I was just studying out of a I was just teaching a church the other day out of the book of Acts, and in Acts chapter 8 he quotes out of Isaiah 53. If you read what Acts chapter 8 says Isaiah 53 says in your English translation, and then you go in your English Bible and read what Isaiah 53 says in Isaiah, they're not the same. I mean, they don't read the same. Well, that's to somebody who doesn't realize what's going on and on all the complexity of why it may read differently. It's really downright baffling. I mean, why can't you get it right? Why don't you just go look in Isaiah 53 and make it the same?
Why did you transpose these words?
Yeah, exactly. And when you've studied it, you recognize that we're dealing with sometimes differences in the actual manuscript, in the actual text that is being used. Sometimes the New Testament writer is dealing in a Greek translation and not in the Hebrew. Sometimes he's giving his own Greek translation of the Hebrew that's different from the official Greek translation that has come down to us. There's all kinds of reasons why they may be different. And that's alarming to people until they've worked with translation and realized that translation is... There's no right way to translate. I mean, especially when it comes to the Bible, a lot of people would be horrified to hear me say that. But if you have a sophisticated understanding of the way that language works, you realize there's no right way to translate any more than there's only one right way to say what I mean right now. I mean, there's actually probably 50 or 100 different ways that I could say what I mean right now and communicate exactly the same thing. Why? Because I can use my words in different order, use different vocabulary, approach it differently. I still get to the same goal of communicating the same thing, but I've used a whole different set of words to get there and to communicate that to people. Well, in translation, one thing got said in the original language. Now, if I want to translate that into English, how do I say that thing? Well, if there's 50 or 100 ways to say what I want to say, there's 50 or 100 ways to translate what he said in the original language. They're all right. They're all valid. Some are more effective. Some are clearer. Some are maybe easier for one person to access and more difficult for another person to access. But it's not a matter of there being a right or wrong way. And therefore, different people can come up with different English translations. It's not that one is right and one is wrong. They're both right. I mean, if they're assuming they're both right. It's just that they're different.
So if I was to explain what you said today to somebody, I would come up with a lot of different vocabulary, maybe different examples than you did.
Mm-hmm.
But it would still be accurate. Could
right.
Could be accurate. I could be inaccurate. But and if a third person listened to the tape and then told somebody else, it could be an entirely different way of saying it. It could be millions and thousands and millions of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the point that you're getting at.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, so let's go back to our verse. Blessed are the gentle, for they shall inherit the earth. What does it mean, for they shall inherit the earth, Jack?
Okay, there's an interpretive judgment that needs to be made here, because the word that's translated the earth is actually more typically translated the land. And so we have to decide, is he talking to Jews and the promise of the land of Israel to them, or is he really talking about the world, and if he's talking about the world, in what sense? This would get really involved to go deep into it, so I won't, but the bottom line is God made a promise to Abraham way, way, way back. And one of the promises he made to Abraham, he took him to the top of a high mountain. He said, look to the north, look to the east, look to the west, look to the south. It's all yours. and your seed. I'm going to give that to you and your seed. I think that's a different promise than the promise he gave to Abraham when he promised Abraham, I'm going to give you the land between this river and that river, the land of the Kenites and the land of the all those different ites. That was real estate. That was Israel that he was promising to Abraham and his physical seed. But the other promise, I think, was to Abraham and what we could call his spiritual seed, those people who have the same heart as Abraham, Jew and Gentile alike. And to them, I think, he was promising the entire world, the whole planet, everything. Now, the New Testament goes on to say that this world is going to be destroyed and God is going to create a new heavens and a new earth. So I think ultimately the literal fulfillment of what Jesus is talking about is not to inherit this planet, but to inherit the planet that is going to carry the same name in the age to come, the new one, the refashioned one, the recreated one. And it's just going to belong to us. It's another way of saying, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. That is, you are going to be the citizens, the people who are going to people this new world that God is going to create, where he's going to establish his kingdom and Jesus is going to reign as king. You're going to be the citizens of that kingdom. Everyone else is going to forfeit their right to be there.
So it's kind of saying yours is the opportunity for access to everything.
Exactly, yeah.
Or the promise, not just the opportunity, but the promise.
The promise, the guarantee, yeah.
To access everything.
Notice the irony of it. For those of you who feel entitled to nothing, you are going to inherit everything.
Yeah, quite an irony.
Yeah.
Those of you who don't think that you should have it, that it's, you're not entitled to it, that you don't presume it, you get it.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, you know, what we could say is, we could kind of make up this superficial rule of, well, okay, then I'll just remember to not presume that I should have it.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's kind of the direction we would go. And that's not what we're talking about here again. We're talking about a heart that fully recognizes who they are before God. It's a humbled heart. It's a contrite and broken heart, as David says in the Psalm.
Yeah, yeah. And no amount of mouthing the words or mimicking that brokenness is legitimate. Can't do that. It's either there or it's not there. God's either put it there or he's not put it there. God's either produced that hardness or it's not. We can't make it happen.
You know, some people might be thinking that are listening, okay, well, what do you mean? I don't have any control of this. I can't get there, but I want to. It's important to me that I get there. And I would say to those people, if you really want to, if that's important to you, you're probably there.
Mm-hmm.
You're on your way. God has at least planted the seed. Certainly for myself, when I first came to believe, came to really open my eyes to see, oh, I get it. Jesus is the answer around here. I see that. I still would not have qualified to be a person that you could call non-entitled. I certainly was presumptuous. In fact, in the beginning of my Christian life, I did things in order to make myself or think I made myself worthy of God. I did a lot of Bible study. I went to a Bible college. I have said these things many times on the radio. I did a lot of stuff that I thought would qualify me for God's grace. And it took me years to recognize that those things didn't qualify me for God's grace, but just this work that he has done in my heart to help me recognize my need for him through seeing my own sins, through seeing my own motivations, my own intention of heart, and to be over and over and over again confronted with that, see it clearly, mourn over it. And that's happened over our course of years. So I'd say if people are saying, I want it, just hang around. God's at work.
Yeah, but well said. Absolutely. The right response when I feel the hopelessness of my situation is to say, God, have mercy upon me, a sinner. And like Jesus said in the parable, that's the one who goes out of the house justified. That is my qualification as a child of God. That makes me one of these people. Is when I, instead of trying to defend myself and make it happen, I just fall on my face and say, God, there's nothing I can do here to make myself worthy of you. I am not entitled, and I know I'm not entitled, and I can't make myself entitled. But what am I going to do then? I'm stuck. And God, if you don't do it, it's not going to get done. God is not going to turn that person away. And
yeah.
That's the promise of the
scriptures.
That's it.
That's it. You don't have to do it right.
Yeah.
So, just to reiterate, I might look at these passages and say, these verses and say, okay, I'm not poor in spirit. I see that I'm a very haughty or arrogant or presumptuous or self-righteous person. Oh, am I lost because of that? No, not if that's important to me not to be that way.
Mm-hmm.
Just seeing that and being and mourning over that and repenting of that is the very thing that God's asking. Not that we become so perfect, but that we desire to be people that are humble in spirit.
Right.
And it makes us sad that we're not. And I think about people, Jack, who can't, they're so lost in their hearts. And I talk about these people often, but I want to be their advocate. They're so lost. They can't hardly see anything, but they have this desire to follow after God, even though they can't see Him, even if they can't even see that He's good. They still have a desire to want to see that He's good and to be sad that they can't even see that. Those people inherit the kingdom of God.
Right.
It is this humbled heart that isn't characterized by having it together.
And along those same lines, we've said this before, but again, it's worth emphasizing, I think. It's humbleness of heart, not humbleness of personality. I mean, I think there will be people who are going to be cocky to the end of their day, or going to be gruff to the end of their life, or they have all these kind of odd...
personality traits.
Yeah, personality traits that are, on the one hand, kind of charming, and on the other hand, kind of obnoxious, and combination of both. That's not the issue. I mean, it's not having a personality of self-effacement and a humble personality. It's having a heart that really sees reality the way it is, and is ultimately basing my life and my existence on what I see to be the reality of my life, namely that I am not entitled to anything. That's what's crucial, not how that manifests itself in my style, in relating to people, in my personality, and that kind of thing. I don't mean by that personalities can't be affected by sin in such a way that they are marred by my sin. They probably are. I think that's true. Although there's probably more room for diversity there than I appreciate. But the bottom line is not change your personality to become more like what Jesus wants. It's see the transformation of your heart take place. That's what's crucial.
So often, Jack, if there's a transformation of my heart, there's some transformation of my personality also.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that follows pretty far behind very often.
I remember my grandfather, as a young child, he always seemed a little gruff to me. But as he got older and older and older, the gruffness never went away, but there was a softness under the gruffness. And that's what I think inevitably has to happen as my heart changes. I don't take myself so seriously. I don't take myself too seriously. And whenever I don't take myself too seriously, regardless of what my personality is, it kind of softens all the rough edges of my personality. And that inevitably will happen, I think, and has to happen. But I don't know that we often see in this lifetime a total transformation of personalities.
I'm kind of stuck in large part with myself, and
yeah.
You're stuck with me, huh?
And you with me.
Yeah, that's right. You with me. Me with you.
Many spiritual leaders promise to satisfy our spiritual yearning for peace and enlightenment. Even many Christians believe that one can be a super Christian and rise above moral and physical limitations. Mackenzie Study Center staff member Larry Barber objects to these claims in his News and Views article, Real Spirituality. By looking at 1 Corinthians and Romans, Larry shows how the Apostle Paul saw spirituality. That is, it's a process whereby the Spirit of God reveals to us the truth about God, ourselves, and the world. It is not a state of consciously feeling closer to God. It is the pursuit of righteousness in a fallen world with other fallen people like ourselves. Please call Mackenzie at 541 541- 1-800-485-4801 for your free News and Views article, Real Spirituality.
At the end of our programs in the last several weeks, we have asked you listeners to consider contributing to Christianity at Work financially. In the course of us asking for financial contributions, Jack and I, as you know, have been rather reticent to do this, and a little bit, not because we don't believe in this program, we sincerely and honestly and deeply believe in it. And yet, how do you ask for contributions? I know that, Jack, you have some real concerns about how contributions are often elicited. Can you share that concern with us?
Well, I think I've mentioned in the past that it's so easy, it's so tempting to manipulate people by hyping what we are doing, or by somehow appealing to people at an emotional level where we move their emotions. And for people who are like me, many Christians have grown up in an environment where to be moved emotionally is equated with being moved by the Spirit of God. And over the course of time, I think I've just simply come to see that that's just not true. There are many times in my life where I have been moved emotionally and had nothing to do with the Spirit of God. And the more I study the Scriptures about what the Spirit of God does, the Spirit who's called the Spirit of Truth by Jesus in the Gospel of John, we know that the Spirit is moving when things become clear to me, when my mind is enlightened and I begin to understand what's important, what's valuable, what's true, what's relevant, and out of that clarity I become persuaded to follow God, to serve God, and obey God. That's what it means to be moved by the Spirit of God. So as people approach the question of financial giving, if they're going to ask the question, well, is God moving me to support this program, the question a person should ask is not, have I been emotionally kind of swept into a precipitous decision to write a check to this program, but rather, as they sit back and reflect, the question is the kind of Christianity that is being propounded by this program, the kind of Christianity that I believe in, the values that I believe in, the truth that I believe in, and something, therefore, that I want to support? And is the actual vehicle of that program something that I think is valuable enough that it needs to be supported? If with some kind of clarity and some kind of persuasion, I can answer yes to those questions, and I have an interest, therefore, in being a part of what this program is doing, then that is the movement of the Spirit of God, if I am rightly understanding how the Spirit works, and I think I do. So if you listeners can answer those questions, yes, I like that Christianity going out, yes, that program is doing a good job of doing that, and you want to be a part of it, then I would welcome you to join us in making this possible through your contributions.
And Jack, sometimes when I say that yes, it's an emphatic yes, and that also is an emotional welling up inside of me that as we've spoke of before, especially in our, well, in our series in the past, many times we've used the word passion. Does it well up in me a passion for what I want here? And if it does, then I can give. So it isn't really apart from emotion, but the emotion comes out of a well-thought-out understanding of what I'm doing.
Yeah, the emotion emerges from clarity of understanding.
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program, would like to order other programs, or want to know more about Mackenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, please call us at 541-485-4801. Again, that's area code 541-485-4801. You can write us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And you may also find us on the net at www.mackenziestudycenter.org. Tapes can be purchased with check or Visa card. If you desire to support the ministry of Mackenzie Study Center, your gift will be entirely tax deductible. Please mail your check to Mackenzie Study Center. Again, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. The telephone number again, 541-485-4801. Now, On behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.